Harry Styles, man.
Oh.
Billie Eilish. Yay!
Yay! Oh, yeah, and to be clear, that is Y-E, not Y-A-Y.
That is Y-E, Kanye, who, by the way, as we're speaking, there is breaking news that he was just arrested for assault or charged with assault or something.
Oh,
so
God.
That's, let's put a question mark next to yay. Let's make a yay.
Yeah, yay, question mark. Might not be appearing yay on Sunday night of Coachella 2022, but it sounds like Dave Holmes will be there.
I might have to be. Here's the thing. I'm looking at this lineup and I'm seeing names that I recognize, and I'm either excited or I'm relieved to see some names that I recognize, you know?
Yes.
There it seems to me that each day there would be people I'd want to see, and most of the time I would probably check out before the headliner. You know, Harry Styles I'd like to see.
Yeah.
Billy Eilish I could take or leave. Kanye West, I just don't care. But it's a really good lineup this year.
I mean, I know people are upset that Carly Rae Jepsen is down, like three lines down in one of those smaller typefaces for Friday or Saturday
night. Yeah, all around people and acts that you can't tell whether they're like bands or documentaries.
Yeah, Carly's a headliner.
Carly should be a headliner. They should be more forward thinking than that. But we got Kim Petras. We got Orville Peck. We got Maggie Rogers. We got Arlo Parks. We got Caroline Polachek. Japanese Breakfast also should be higher up. A ton of acts that I actually want to see.
You lost me after a couple of those. I haven't heard of most of them, but...
Okay, I'll whip you up a little playlist. Here's the thing, though. Is it insane to be a 50-year-old man at Coachella?
I think you have to go simply for the Esquire piece that you'll get out of it, out of the experience.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the fish out of water experiential essay it's like half written in my head already. But the thing is, it's not going to be any easier to be a 51-year-old man at Coachella. Actually, you know what? I will be a 51-year-old man by the time April comes around. So it won't be any easier to be a 52-year-old man at Coachella.
But when's the last one you went to?
The second one. The second one ever. Wow. With Bjork and Oasis and also checked out. I mean, I saw Bjork. I think I did not see Oasis. Saw G-Love and Special Sauce. This is where my head was at in a 2002 or 3 or whatever it was. I don't know. It just looks so utterly ridiculous. And I feel old in any gastropub already. So I think like in this place, I'm going to feel unbelievably old, but I may have to go. I just may have to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the last time I went, I was probably 32 at the oldest. And
which one? Which one?
That
who
one.
Are the headliners?
I know Robin was playing the last time that I went.
Oh, okay.
And I know that I couldn't have been older than 32, and I felt quite old then. So I can only imagine what you're in for.
Yeah. I mean, I will appear like a chaperone, and that's, I guess, fine. Biba Doobie will be there. Belly. There's Fatboy Slim.
Oh, that one I've heard of.
Listen, there's a lot going on. It could be a very good Coachella. If you go and you see me there, just be kind. Just respect your elders and be kind. Saw Scream the other night. Matt McConkey.
I'm going tonight.
You're going tonight.
I thought that you didn't like horror movies.
I don't like horror movies.
And have you seen all of the Screams?
I've seen the first two Screams.
Okay. Those are the most important two.
Sure. Got an email about a press screening. Got to go. Got to bring a guest. I should have reached out, but
I signed
Matt
up.
Mercer.
I've RSVP'd and then flaked.
Okay. Well, it's honestly, was that a gay screening? Because after the we kind of just went right in and were like the last to take their seats, and I didn't notice the crowd until after it was over. But then it was just like, oh, I'm fully at the Abbey right now.
Yeah.
It was a very, yeah. And it feels like it was the same thing for The Eyes of Tammy Faye a few months back. So maybe we're just on a list of gay movie fans. Anyway, I have a friend who's a big horror guy. Ben is definitely not. So I said, you know what? Why don't the two of us go and see Scream?
And I mean, obviously no spoilers, but.
No spoilers, but I felt nothing.
You felt nothing?
I felt nothing. Mm. I felt nothing. Those movies, by and large, do not frighten me. We've talked about this. They don't scare me so much as they make me sad. I always feel bad for the pointless loss of life.
Sure, sure.
Didn't even feel that this time around.
Oh, God. But I guess I feel mostly excited to see my old friends, but you don't have the same sure. emotional connection to Sidney Prescott, Gale Weathers.
I don't. I mean, no, I don't. And I don't. I don't know whether that means it wasn't well done. My horror friend who I brought loved it.
Okay, good.
So I take his word that it was a well done movie. That wasn't for me. But yeah, it may just be exhaustion and maybe I just don't care about human life as much as I did the last time I saw a slasher movie. I don't know. But I mean, listen, if you liked them, you will like it, I think.
Great. I love
them. And Jack Quaid could get it.
Can't wait. Cannot wait. And I've got some theories and I'm half looking for spoilers and half avoiding them to see if my theories are right. But
okay.
I'll report back.
Are you willing to share a theory? I'm not going to, I'll hide myself.
The theory that I actually think is more wishful thinking than a theory, but is that one of the guys from part one who appeared to be killed, but his death wasn't like double confirmed, is going to come back and be the killer. And the reason I'm hoping for that is that there's no other version of a reveal that will be satisfying. It can't be one of the core three that would like one of our heroes is suddenly the bad guy. Not interested in that.
Yeah, pull the rug right off.
One of these new kids. We don't care about them. We just met them. It was the kids in Scream 4. You know, What could actually be surprising is a Jamie Kennedy or Matthew Lillard and. Hold that thought because
wait a minute.
I'm about to start screaming in a whole other way.
Wait a minute, America. Wait a minute, Matt McConkey and America.
Our guest is logging in. He has entered the chat. There he is.
There he is.
Hi guys.
Cheyenne Jackson.
Cheyenne, thank you America. For being here.
The world. Cheyenne Jackson. How are you?
Oh,
I'm good. I mean, how is anybody right now? It's the world is off.
How is anybody? What's a day in your life right now? I mean, it's 4 p.m. as we're recording this. What has today been like for you?
Okay, so I have 5-year-old twins, and they get me up at about 6 or 6:15 every day. But I've made a little deal with myself that no matter when my call time is from a show, I'll work out prior. Do something prior, because otherwise I just can't get it in. And during COVID, I really had to make that time for self-care, because it's just been, as we know, absolutely bonkers. So today, I got up at about 5:15 and went and did a little workout in my garage. My kids got up. My daughter pulled me outside and made me watch the sunrise. She called it a pink-a-blue. She's like, Daddy, you have to see the pink-a-blue. It's from this cartoon called Pinkalicious. And
wow,
the pink-a-blue was incredible today.
It was a gorgeous sunrise today.
And then I had breakfast, quick breakfast with the family, and then I drove to work. And then we did notes on the new script, and then we rehearsed it all day. And then we had a studio run through at 2, or network run through at 2. Here we are.
And here we are. So will you tape tomorrow?
Tomorrow we do the whole thing again, and then we have the studio run through tomorrow. So gotcha. We're going to get rewrites tonight, and then we'll do the whole thing again. Yeah, this is my first sitcom, and it's so fast. We will shoot this on Monday and Tuesday, and then late into the night on Tuesday, and then Wednesday morning we will be starting another episode. So you don't have time to like get through in your head. You got to just like make a choice and move the fuck on. So that's been one of my favorite things about doing
multicam.
Normally with the multicam, you also get the fun of performing for a live audience. But do you have a live audience right now?
No, we don't. No. We have our writers, we have our producers, and we have our grips, and everybody standing around in masks and shields going like, It's pretty fun. We hold for the invisible laugh.
Yeah. Right.
Have you had to sort of work extra hard to get it up as it were without the audience there?
It has been, honestly, Matt, it's been one of the hardest things because, I mean, well, like Leslie Jordan has done probably 40 sitcoms and Swoosie Kurtz has done so many episodes. So luckily I'm with people that do this for a living and are masters at this. But I've really had to, it's been a big learning curve. Like I'm a big person. I'm 6'4". So I'm always like, the first season, I always felt like I was covering somebody's, because there's 5 cameras. But the timing and the energy, having to go out and generate that when we have masks and our shields and goggles all the way up until action. And then we rip it off and we see each other's mouths for the first time. And then we're like trying to connect, I'm not complaining by any means because this is a tough time to be making art, but it's very, very challenging for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like it.
I mean, but you know, we're this year we are in more of a groove. We have a new showrunner. This one is hard. It is. I mean, you have to tell 6 stories in 23 minutes.
Yeah, but you're doing it.
It's amazing. And you're obviously, you know, have a packed schedule between work and family, but when you do have downtime, what are you watching right now, or what movies or music or TV are you loving?
I mean, with the new season of British Bake Off, we just finished last night. The only time I have to watch TV is after I get home and I'm with the kids and we put them down. And then Jason and I have like 90 minutes to 2 hours to like talk about our day, decompress, and then watch something. So yeah, we've gone through like all of the movies, all of the Oscar mm-hmm. movies. We just saw Being the Ricardos, finished Succession. You know, all the stuff, The Lost Daughter.
Oof. Haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, that one has really stayed with me.
I got my stack of screeners as well. I haven't gotten to that one.
No, yeah, it's so beautiful. But as a parent, it was so triggering. Yeah. And so like it started and I looked at Jay, I'm like, I don't know if I can watch this right now. Because I'm already a sensitive empath type of man. And it's all about parenting. And should you have kids? And if you do, what decisions do you make? And will those decisions impact them their whole lives? And it's a heartbreaking movie. But yeah, like you said, Matt, it stays with you and you it haunts you. Kind of like, did you see Power of the Dog?
Yes. Oof. Incredible.
Again, like it takes a couple of days and you're thinking and you're unraveling and that's what really good storytelling and good art does. That's what I love the British Bake Off. I find it to be the kindest, sweetest, actually really exciting thing. Like you're so into whether, you know, Margot's plan is gonna wilt.
Yeah.
Like it's true drama. I'm telling you, but I love how kind everybody is to each other. And I don't know, there's some delicious escape. And I think that's what kind of we're all craving with our media.
And when it doesn't work out, you feel their deep disappointment and the judge's disappointment. Everyone wants everyone to succeed. And when it doesn't happen, it's just like, oh, you've really,
I know.
What have you done?
You really let us down. You have a soggy bottom today. Yeah. It's very, very.
Did you get into the pottery one? The Great Pottery Throwdown?
No.
Cheyenne Jackson. That's what's next for you.
I wonder if
it's very good. Yeah. I really like it.
Because I love eating so much. I think that's why the bake-off. But I will give pottery, based on your recommendation,
you should.
I will do
that. The, kind of the Paul Hollywood of that show. I forget his name. But he looks like he's from Prodigy. Like he's got sort of like punky hair. Uh-huh. And he's kind of intimidating. Uh-huh. But when he really loves an urn, he'll cry over it. And it's not your typical reality TV tears where he's really trying to call them up. He is desperately trying to hold back tears and he can't do it. He feels so strongly about earthenware. It's hard not to be swept up in it.
Next.
Oscar movie wise, did you see Coda?
Not yet.
I'm all about Coda. I'm so pro Coda. Oh yeah.
Really?
I'm shouting it from the rooftops.
I saw Marley Matlin at a thing right before everything shut down again. And everybody was talking to her about it, and there was quite the buzz. And it looks incredible.
I was just thinking what you were saying about British Bake Off and how the kindness specifically is the most rewarding part. And then I'm thinking, like, it's amazing that it doesn't feel like the U.S. has sort of gotten that, and that entertainment can be kind and still be incredibly satisfying. But then I realized, well, you are on a show currently that it very much trades in kindness.
For sure. And that's actually one of the things that drew me to it. I mean, I was on American Horror Story for 4 years, still had time left on my contract, if I'm being honest. But I had just kind of changed. I had become a dad, and my whole energy shifted. And I'll be forever grateful to Ryan Murphy for all those creepy, wonderful opportunities. And Sarah Paulson, who, sidebar, should have been nominated for the SAG for impeachment.
God. Yeah.
Big time.
I've known her for 13 years. She changed her walk. She changed her voice. She was, oh my God.
For the Lean Cuisine work alone, she deserves it. the peeling back of the cellophane to reveal the Lean Cuisine. She lived, it felt lived in.
It did feel very lived in. That was a really nice touch, I thought. But I mean, learning from her on set, learning from Kathy Bates, learning from these incredible, incredible artists, that was the most wonderful thing. But just, there was one night, I think it was like 3 or 4 in the morning, I'd been like, you know, butchered or beheaded or something, and I was covered in blood, and I got home as the sun was coming up, and then I went to check on my little babies in the cribs, and I was just like, there's just this, I'm not somebody who can do a role and then just like it's done and I'm done for the day, and it really sticks to me, and it was starting to stick to me. And so I talked to Ryan, and I said, I want to make a change, and I want to do something else. And he let me out of my contract, which I thought was really great. And I needed that change. I needed that. There is a place for American Horror Story, and I will always love it. And I still watch it and love it, but for me and who I am right now and who I want to be in the world, it just was a better match.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, Call Me Cat came. And again, if I'm being honest, because why not? I'm really tired. I turned down the audition.
Really?
Because it said love interest for Mayim Bialik on a network sitcom. And I was like, you know what? They're not going to cast me in this.
Right.
Like, they're just not. They're not going to cast a gay dude. I can't believe we're still having that conversation, but my always already way of thinking of my own internalized homophobia and my own insecurities. I was just thinking, like, it's probably going to be pretty close. It's probably going to be between me and a couple other people. It'll get down to the test. I don't want to go through that pain, because at the end of the day, I can't imagine a group of, you know, execs going like, him, he's the guy, he's going to be the one. Because I believe that I don't think there's been another openly gay guy cast in a network sitcom as a male, straight male lead from the jump.
Yeah.
But I just kind of put this weird thing on myself, like, it's not going to happen. And luckily my agent was like, you're ridiculous. Read the script. Mayim Bialik is amazing. You know, read it. And I did. And it was so sweet and cute. And Matt, like you said, it was so positive and it was so much light. And I knew, I didn't know the British show that it was based on. But I watched that and I thought, oh, if we could capture any of a fraction of that charm. And then I read with Mayim and we had an instant connection. I've loved her since Beaches, like everybody.
Oh, of course.
And we just had a spark. And then it just kind of happened. We started doing the things, and turns out I was the guy. And the only person that didn't think I could do it was me.
I love that. So you're talking about the process of getting close, and then the straight guy gets it. You spoke of that in a way that seemed familiar. Is that a cycle you've been through a time or two?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I don't have any stone cold evidence of that. Who knows what happens behind the closed doors of casting offices and stuff. But yeah, I definitely have experienced being second a lot or third, and then you see who ends up getting it. And everybody has these people. Everybody has their one or two people. But one of the great gifts of this show is that I've let go of putting myself in any box. I've spent so much of my life and my career. I'm this guy, this is what I'm going to be doing. And no more boxes for me. I can do drama. I can do comedy. I can sing. I can do this. I'm going to just do it all. And that is the way that I want this to roll from here.
You've had such an interesting trajectory because you, I think, didn't act professionally until you were 27, which for theater people can be considered late.
Yeah.
But also, when you did start, you moved to New York and you were on Broadway like 3 weeks later and then never stopped working. So it was like, in one way, you were this late bloomer, but in the other way, you were kind of this undeniable force.
I will take that. Yes.
How do you think that shaped you, starting quote unquote late?
Yeah, I think it served me. And really, I didn't get my first, I wasn't a professional actor until I was 27. And before that, I was grown up in the world. I had lots of different jobs. I worked as a bank teller. I worked at a health club. I sold ads for a magazine. I'd gone through a lot of personal pain. I had a lot to offer. But I had this nagging feeling inside of me that I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing with my life. And I was in Seattle and I was doing musical theater. And so many people said, like, you should go to New York. You have something special. And in my mind, I didn't go to college. So I've always had this chip on my shoulder that I'm not educated enough. I can't compete. I didn't go to Juilliard. So who the fuck am I to think I can go? But two things happened really close to each other. We had a death in our family, my brother's little girl, and then 9/11. And the devastation of both of those things, personally and then to the world, really just lit a fire under me like nothing else. And I just said, no, 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 I'm going to go. I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to try. And I'm going to do it. I mean, I was like Naomi Malone. I'm going to go and I'm going to dance.
Yeah.
And I went and literally got off the plane. I had one friend in New York who was a Broadway actor at the time. I met him and he was in a local thing in Seattle. And he said, if you're ever in New York, call me. I'll hook you up with my agent. So I did. I walked in, I read and sang, they signed me. And yeah, my first audition was for Thoroughly Modern Millie. And they had just won the Tony for Best Musical. And they were looking for a replacement or an understudy for both of the male leads, the young Gavin Creel male lead, and then Mark Kudish, the older male lead. And I'm the guy that's always looked a little young and a little old, even when I was like 16. So, and I can sing really low and I can sing really high. And it was just, I knew that this was mine. I didn't even have headshots yet.
Wow.
But I walked in and I just, before I knew what manifesting was, I just was the guy. Now I know it's manifestation and be undeniable. Then they have to choose you. But I was just like, oh yes, I'm getting this. Oh, I have to tap dance. I don't know how to tap dance, but I will learn. Like it was, I wish I had that confidence now sometimes. It's like, who the fuck did I think I was? But like, that's what passion and drive and believing in yourself can actually manifest sometimes.
Yeah, it's just believing in destiny. It's just knowing you're stepping into it.
Yeah. And then it ended up, my next door neighbor in New York ended up being Jerry Orbach.
Come on.
The late, great Broadway star. And most people know him from Law and Order and a million other things, but he became my mentor. First of many mentors. I really believe in mentors. And he gave me beautiful, wonderful advice all along the way. And he said one of his pieces of advice that I really tried to use now. And that is, say yes to everything. If you can, Like sometimes you think things are beneath you or I'm not going to do that. I did a movie last year. This will make sense in a second, but I did a movie last year called Borderlands. It's based on a video game. Huge, incredible cast. I couldn't believe I was there with them. Like Cate Blanchett and Jamie Lee Curtis and Jack Black and Kevin Hart. And Jamie Lee Curtis and I became really close really fast. And she was telling me, you know, people made fun of her when she did the yogurt commercials that make you poop and this and that. But she's like, her main two quotes, I think, are so powerful. She says, if not me, then who? And if not now, then when?
Yeah.
And she said, once I started living like that, each one of those little jobs that people would make fun of me for led to me meeting this person, which led to this person, which led to me being in Knives Out, which led to whatever. And so this idea of like trying to curate the perfect little career, I let go of. And now I'm, you know, I'm Hades on the Disney Descendants movies on the Disney Channel. So I'm super big with 9-year-olds, but then I'm also on a sitcom and you know, doing a movie with Jack Black. So it's like, I'm trying to just go absolutely with and say yes to everything.
And
kind of a cool
dream. And very few people do have that, like what we think of as a traditional, like Hollywood career, where it's like, this is my thing. I'm this actor and they're going to keep casting me in this right. kind of thing. Like it's, you're expected to do a whole lot of different things now. So you might as well just do it. Get good at it.
Yeah.
So you're in New York in your late 20s, you're on Broadway, you're living your best life.
Yeah.
And you are, and I know that the conversation in the Broadway community around like, yeah, you're this tall leading man guy who can play romantic leads. Are you going to be out? Are you not going to be out? I know that is and was different there than it has been like in, you know, the film and TV world. But were there still voices around you encouraging you to, you know, to not come out?
100%. It was in, I want to say 2006 or 2007. Whenever I did, I played Elvis in this show called All Shook Up. It's a big jukebox musical. My first big lead, my face in a billboard on Times Square. It was like my moment, you know, and my dad, I grew up listening to Elvis and it was my moment. Right. And I it was so exciting and it was very, you know, I had never experienced being in the eye of the storm of a new musical and being like the star or whatever. And I remember the New York Times wanted to do a piece and a profile. And my agent at the time said, you know, they're going to ask about your sexuality, they ask about your personal life. You know, maybe we just kind of don't say anything about that. And I was like, what? No way. I'm not going to be somebody who is always trying to remember the correct pronoun if I'm, you know, when I'm talking about my significant other or I'd always been out since I was 19. I could not even imagine a world where I wasn't. And I think I had the confidence of playing, you know, this super masculine, sexy part in this big thing where I was like, I don't think it's going to be an issue. I mean, I was a little naive, but I think it was a great decision because, you know, I kind of look at it like if somebody was going to not cast me because of that, I don't want to be in that shit anyway.
And you were already doing the thing that they are implying you would be prevented from doing, you know?
Yeah. It was just, yeah. And so, yeah, there were definitely conversations around there. And actually at that time, The Bachelor reached out and said, we want to have a conversation with you about possibly being I'm like, I don't think that would work out very well.
Or would it work out?
I've literally never even been with a woman. And I'm not going to do it for the first time on TV.
Wow.
But I'd watch a season of The Bachelor that was a single Cheyenne with a bunch of gentlemen callers.
Oh my God.
One of very few
and here we have
who could pull that off. Oh boy. Did you watch Coming Out, Colton?
I watched one of them. I watched the first one just to get a sense of it. And And I think it's an important story to tell. I think it's, he represents a lot of people who are, I mean, I'm all about people discovering their truth and, you know, living their best life. And Gus Kenworthy is a buddy. Oh, so nice. Yeah, it was fun.
So, I mean, it was, you know, I rolled my eyes when I heard about it, but it is like, it's, you know, there's, it's well done, you know?
I mean,
would I have wanted a camera anywhere near me 2 seconds after I came out? No.
Oh my God.
No.
Oh my God. No.
What was Cheyenne Jackson like in those early days?
Oh my God. I came out at 19. I come from a really teeny town, very, very, very poor. We had no running water. We had an outhouse like in the woods, super Christian. I went on 3 mission trips. So I was a, you know, missionary with my church. It was all about Jesus and all about the church. The town I'm from is right outside the Aryan Nation compound in northern Idaho.
Oh boy.
So, you know, very white, very racist. It just is. I'm not judging. It's just a fact. Well, I'm judging. But it is around that time, I graduated at 17 from high school, and then I moved to Spokane, the big city, and found my people. I found my tribe. I did my first community theater. I did my first summer stock. I was around the first time I'd ever been around people of color, either queer people, and very quickly realized, oh, this is where I belong and this is who I am. And we were doing 7 brides for 7 brothers. And I think I slept with 6 of the 7 brothers just to make sure.
It's important.
And, it's important. It's super important. And so I was definitely sure, definitely knew who I was. And around that time, my brother, who is a pastor now and was in Bible college then, I love him dearly and we're really close. And I'd always purposed in my heart that if anybody from my family ever asked me flat out, I would just say it. I wasn't going to prolong it over the years. And one day he just said, you know, have you ever been with a man? And the way he asked it was so specific and like, it was like the record stopped. And I said, just 1 second, excuse me. And I ran into the bathroom and I remember looking at myself in the bathroom mirror, looking at my eyes and I was just thinking like, this is the moment. Like, this is that fucking moment that you have been dreading / waiting for. And I went out and I told him, told him the truth and who I was and explained my whole journey and pain. And he said, well, we have to tell mom and dad and I'll help you. So I wrote a letter because I knew I'd be too emotional to speak. And we planned a family meeting and, you know, we did the family meeting and in this letter, I like let it all hang out and talked about, you know, it was probably too much on reflection, probably too graphic, but I was like, they need to hear it all. And so I wrote it in the letter and my brother's job was to read the letter because I couldn't talk. I just opened the meeting by saying, I love you all. We were a family that's always been really honest, but the biggest thing you don't know about me is that I'm gay. And then I remember my mom was sitting on the edge of the couch and she kind of dropped off the couch and was sitting on the carpet. Wow. And my dad was looking straight ahead. My little sister started crying. My brother started reading the letter and then he started editing it because he thought, oh, they won't be able to handle that. And I was like, read it all. Stop editing. You wanted
to get into the details about the 6 of the 7 brothers.
Yeah. I think it was too much. Yeah. Dave, if there was a camera anywhere near me, I mean, my head would have exploded. So I can't even imagine that. Then we had to take a little sabbatical from each other. My mom and dad and I. Yeah, they had to really mourn. They had to mourn their idea of what they thought life was going to be like for me. But that was, you know.
So how did the sabbatical end?
Enough time went by that I think they realized, you know, I think their first thought was like, you know, are you going to get AIDS? Are you going to, you know, all of the things that people thought 20 years ago, the first things that, you know, just health and like sadness and are you still going to be able to have kids and all of those things. I think once we all hung around each other and they realized I was the same guy, my dad always called me shiny. And once he knew that I was like the same shiny that I always was, we just kind of got on with it. And then I got a boyfriend and I introduced him to them, and it was super awkward and terrible. And life went on and years went by and they just kind of slowly got used to it and are great. My dad passed a few years ago, but my mom is, I'm closer to my family than I've ever been. And it's a goddamn miracle is what it is.
Yeah. What denomination is your brother who's the pastor?
Non-denominational. So very spirit-filled, speaking in tongues, very evangelical. He's incredible. My brother's an incredible pastor and a great communicator and leader, and is doing great things with his church. And he is, educating people through his own experience with me. And he's, he's a cool pastor. What can I say? I mean, like it's been a learning and growth period for our whole family.
So how did you meet your husband?
I met Jason one Sunday afternoon across a crowded AA meeting room in West Hollywood.
Wow.
Going on 10 years ago. I had just recently gotten sober, and so had he. And, you're not supposed to, in the program, you're not supposed to start anything new when you are so newly sober yourself. But, I saw his adorable, bitchy little face, and I was like, I'm marrying him.
Wow.
And yeah, it was fast and furious. And it was the first time in my life where I could see myself with somebody forever, period. Not even like, could I, or maybe? He's just my person, done. I never thought that was possible.
What was it about him, aside from the, as you described it, the bitchy face?
It was a knowingness. It was a comfort. It was a humor. Obviously there was physical attraction, but most of all, there was an ease. I spent a lot of my life being really uncomfortable in my own skin, and which is one of the reasons I started drinking, just because I just felt uncomfortable. And through therapy and other things, I've realized where a lot of it stemmed from, just my own internalized homophobia, also the objectification of, I've been objectified for most of my life. It's kind of strange to say, but like, even as like a 16, 17, 18 year old guy, like the first thing that someone would talk about when it come to me was not who I was, but what I look like, what my body looked like, what my legs look like. And you would think like, oh, how great. And yeah, poor you. I'm not complaining, but it is something, there is something to it when, that is all that people think about when they think about you, or the first thing that is spoken about you. And it just made me uncomfortable for so long. And so I would drink. And so I would, if I was meeting my friends out at the bar, I didn't want to be looked at. I mean, I wanted to be looked at, but I didn't want to be looked at as well. And it was this constant like, oh, is 2 drinks the perfect time? Okay, now I'm warm enough. Now I'm comfortable enough. Now I can be myself. But then I just always wanted more. And, so I'd always been so uncomfortable in my body, and here I was sober and I couldn't numb the pain anymore. But then I met somebody who, just being around him, felt comfortable in my body. I felt comfortable in my skin. And, he's just incredible. He's somebody who just, nobody has lukewarm feelings about Jason. Jason is just the light of every room he's in, and just constant energy, very loud. Mm-hmm. And he's my guy. Wow. And I first time I ever thought, oh, I could see a life with him. I could see a family with him. I was with somebody else for a long time before him, and I never saw a family with him. And with Jason, it just seemed possible and actually probable. So we got married and we had kids pretty quickly after. Our kids will be 6 in October, so.
I'll be damned.
Wow. So when you decide to, you know, pursue having kids, knowing the complications that we face as gay men when we're navigating that, what was most important to you guys when you were sort of weighing your options?
How was it going to happen? Oh, well, we definitely, I wanted to be a dad since I was a kid. I was like the only boy babysitter on the block. I taught Sunday school. I worked at a health club, like I mentioned, but I worked in the childcare department. I ran it and everybody thought I was a trainer. And I'm like, nope, give me your baby. So it was inevitable in that way. I really wanted a biological child. And so did Jason. And so we knew that surrogacy was probably going to be our best and most viable option. So it is a wild, emotional, expensive, sometimes heartbreaking journey, but it was one that we wanted to go down. And what was important to us was to have a lot of women around in our lives, which we already do, but have a company that was really kind of fostered by women, because we just wanted that like kind of bosomy, hippy dippy, warm, you know, thing. So we found this great little company called Fertility Miracles. And she just kind of guided us and fostered us through the whole thing and set us up with, so we had a gestational surrogate and then we had a separate egg donor. So two separate women, and one biologically Jason's, one biologically mine, both in together. And the first time we put them in, they both took.
Wow.
And it was just, I know, it was just what it was. And it was a miracle. Pregnancy is a miracle. And here's a funny story. When the doctor did the implantation, our surrogate was with her husband at the time. We were all together in a room, me and Jason, the doctor, and then our surrogate and her husband. And then he comes out with the vial, you know, the two vials, one inside. It's so crazy. And she's there behind a little curtain, but we can see her face. And, you know, the doctor has her, you know, for modesty, a little curtain. And then the doctor turned down the lights, had some like Enya or something on. It was kind of like weirdly, I don't want to say romantic, but it was definitely moody and kind of magical. And, and then there was a monitor right there and he had the two vials and he just went, boop, boop. And then we looked on the monitor and there were two little lights. And that was
two lights.
Yeah, two little dots.
Amazing.
That showed, you know, that they went in and they became Willow and Ethan.
Wow.
Who are my son and daughter and my, you know, my reason for everything.
Come on. We're seeing a picture.
We're seeing a photo.
So what is there? Yeah. What's the situation now? Are they learning remotely? Are they in a classroom? Mm-hmm.
We started a little of both. We little all of it. Well, Jason's mother lives with us, and she lives in our guest house, and she's incredible. And so she was teaching preschool. And so when the pandemic hit, it was important for us because the kids were going to preschool. It was important for us to maintain a sense of schedule. I love a schedule. I'm very organized. I love things to be, you know, this is too much going on not to be. So every day I would do their hair, put their backpacks on, walk them down the gate, down the stairs to grandma's house to school. And so we did that for an entire year. And then when things kind of got looser and better in the pandemic, they went to public school for about, I guess, 5 months. And they love it and loved it. And then things have spiked again, as we know, with Omicron. So I took them back out. So now they're remotely learning again, but they are so bright, so expressed. So it's just the stuff that comes out of their mouth every day is incredible. And it is such a mirror to you. Matt, are you a dad?
No, I'm getting married in May. And I think that's the next conversation. Mm-hmm. So I'm extra interested in hearing about this process.
I mean, it is the most profound thing. There are no words. It is so painful in the best way. It hurts every day. It hurts you love them so much, it hurts. And it's like, I don't know. I didn't know that I needed this kind of pain, this kind of love pain, but you do. You don't know you need it until you have it. But I also love when people say, I know I'm not going to have kids. I know that's not in the cards for me. I never want to be a dad. I'm like, that's amazing because you know that. I think the worst thing is when people, women in particular, feel like pressure or they're like, oh, I don't know, I should freeze my eggs. I don't even know if I want to be a mom. And you feel like you have to. Don't do it unless you want it more than anything, because once you do it, that's it, folks. Like forever. My therapist always says, you're not raising babies. You're raising people. They're babies for a second. And then they're just two big people coming into your house. You know, it's amazing. And I love it. And it's challenging. And it challenges me and Jason every day. And we have to be a team. And it, oh my God, the fights you have as a parent with your, I mean, I remember Jay, it'd be 3 a.m. and we'd each have one of them on us, like bouncing them. And you'd be like, wow, fuck you. You're not excitable. And the bottles and the thing. And you're so tired and you're, I mean, I didn't scream fuck you. I did that for dramatic effect. But you know, you get the gist. It is like it stretches you to your limit. But then they go to sleep and you're there with your partner and you're with your family you've created, and it's like it's sacred and it's beautiful and it's everything.
I heard you say on another podcast that couples therapy is part of your life, which I'm a fan of, and it of course does not mean that like your relationship is in crisis. Often it means quite the opposite. But what's been the best part of that experience for you?
Yeah, we haven't been in a while. Maybe about 3 or 4 months ago, during the pandemic at the beginning, we really there was just so much togetherness that I didn't know what to do with all that togetherness. So the best thing about therapy is finding ways to really communicate, because isn't that what it's all about? Really, you're with another person. You just want to be heard and you just want them to hear you. It's not about being right. It's not about who wins the fight. You know, it's not even about necessarily being on the same page as it all the time. It's just a matter of really, truly being heard and finding ways to communicate. Jason is an incredible communicator. I was not the best communicator for a long time. My dad was very stoic, Vietnam vet, you know, pop, manly man, didn't say much. So when he did say something, people would be like, oh, David's talking. You know, he was like a cowboy. You know, he was just this cool, cool guy. And I kind of modeled myself after that. I didn't talk a lot. I internalized a lot. And it ended up not serving me in the long run, because it turns out I'm a very emotional, very expressed person when I allow myself to be. And Jason is the most expressed about everything all the time. And he comes from a family where they're like, they get it all out. I come from a family who keeps things in, and they have resentments and they have things they actually want to say to you, but they don't. And it's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. And, you know, I would love like a big Thanksgiving brawl where everyone says, well, you know, did you get it out? And you let off that steam. So yeah, I'm a big fan of couples therapy, therapy in general.
I grew up Catholic. So that the family that you're describing of yours, I don't recognize at all. That's not, that hasn't been my experience.
Fine.
Oh, it's fine. No, everything. No, it's great. Yeah. And then like some weird thing happens and you get yelled at for something you did in 1983. Wow. Wow.
Oh, yeah. You've been holding on to that, Susan. Yeah.
Shana Jackson, thank you for taking time out of a busy day in a Warner Brothers dress. Is this your dressing area? Is this your like office?
Yeah. This is my
fantastic.
This is people at home, you can't see, but this is a Cheyenne. This is a Western. My dad named Clint Walker. Lonely man, Cheyenne, where will you be camping tonight? Anyway, my friends here surprised me one day and put that
That's
in here.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I'll let you.
And on the other wall is a Les Mis poster.
I mean, you got to have the yin and the yang, right?
Absolutely. Cheyenne, thank you so
Cheyenne
much.
Jackson of Call Me Cat mm-hmm. on Fox and 74 Broadway shows and 42 seasons of American Horror Story and everything else. Such an honor that you would do this. Thank you so much.
I'm so happy that I did. And thank you guys for letting me talk and go deep. And anytime I get to talk about the things I love and the people I love, it just deepens my love for those things. So my heart is full and I feel great. So thank you so
You're
much.
You're so welcome. Our love for you, Cheyenne Jackson, has deepened equally. Homophilia is a World of Wonder production, produced and edited by Kate Moldenhauer.
Special thanks to Randy Barbato, Fenton Bailey, Steven Sims, Edward Bochniak, and the whole team at World of Wonder. We love you!
And theme music by my Ben Wise.
Yes, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HomophiliaPod. You can give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening. We love you!